Mostly, the demonic, idolatrous forces dominate our churches now, I think. That's a judgment, you see. But demonic, in the sense, what our preacher would do would be to take Romans 5:5, and then we'll forget this. You know, the law entered that sin might abound. But where sin doth abound, grace doth much more abound. What he preached upon, that was read. What he preached upon, grace abounds. It just abounds. Now I believe it abounds. But the law enters, in a sense, to drive you to your knees so that you can receive that grace. And if you don't have the law and grace going together in any church, you are really getting an idolatrous church, it seems to me. And you see, now how could I change that situation? Because over 30 years, he had developed a congregation that believed that way. I had to act with the wisdom of the children of darkness. I didn't open my mouth in that church for 9 years about what I believed. But I called the new minister. And everybody loved me. Now there are a few who recognized that I was what I was, that I was. And after we got the 2 months after we got the new minister, we had to get 90% of the congregation to approve the minister. We couldn't have gotten 90% 2 months after he came, after he started preaching this stuff. But sin, one woman said, I hate that word. Now that, you see, what? Well, I went up and I put my arms around her. I said, Helen, I mean, we love you and we differ, but we love you. That's actually what happened. But people were just shaken to their boots by this preaching of sin, by anything which really judged them. Man. So I agree with you that there's a sense in which the proclamation of the word and Gene Twyhide is going to help me. It would help to have another utensil, wouldn't it? We face a real cancer in our society, and I guess my chief aim to infamy is that I spent 7.5 years, major part of my time, working on this cancer at the very heart of the freedom movement in Chicago. That's to say, I was at the very top, as far as a white person could be near the top, from 1963 until 1971, when I finally dropped out, January 1971, of what was going on in the broad freedom movement in Chicago. And it was kind of a happenstance that I got there, but I got there. And I got in early and formed a lot of relations and was able to stay there. So when King was in Chicago, the strategy sessions were in my living room. And I only say that to illustrate that I'm not speaking kind of out of a textbook, but I'm speaking out of experience. In my judgment, we're in trouble. And I think Holden Village illustrates it. But the Lutheran Church illustrates it, and the city of Chicago illustrates it, and the nation illustrates it, and every institution I've ever been a part of it illustrates it. There are two Americas. There are really two Americas. There's a black America and there's a white America. And nothing that has happened in the last 10 years, 5 years, has done anything to change that situation. I think the situation is worse now than it was. And you measure the explosive quality of a situation by the difference between fulfillment and expectation. And I like to say, at the turn of the century, the black expectation were here and the fulfillment was a long way away. But by 1970, the black expectations are way out here and the fulfillment is here. That we have moved, but the gap, the explosive gap between fulfillment and expectation is broadened. And it's a very dangerous gap, very dangerous gap. You can't afford in any human being, any of you know psychology, to get this gap between fulfillment and expectation too broad. So you either have to deal with the expectation or the fulfillment. What's happened in this country, for various reasons, which we might look at, is that the expectation of the black has increased. He now expects to be treated like a white person. That is to say, for a long time, he thought that he was a second-class citizen. I mean, the whole culture taught him that he was a second-class citizen, second-class human being. But now he doesn't feel he is. In fact, he thinks he's a double-A first-class. Many, many, and you can't generalize, but the growing expectation is to be treated with compensatory activity, not simply like white people, but with compensatory opportunity for all the things. So we hear reparations, and we ought to hear reparations for all the things that have been done to black people in this country. So we have, I'd say, a very, very dangerous situation in this country. And things are getting worse, I think. They're certainly not getting any better. And I just wanted to read you a little passage that occurred in our Sun-Times newspaper recently, which was from an Associated Press report, the Sun-Times of April 16th. According to Bernard Ganser, the ashes have cooled in the burned ghetto of America's long hot summers, but the bitterness remains. So too the despair and poverty and frustration that fueled the bloody riots of the 1960s. In a five-city report, Ganser points to the picture of our trouble. Quote, rain, sun, wind have weathered away the stain and stink of the blood and fire of riots in Watts, Detroit, Newark, Chicago, and Washington. As bad as things were then in the 1960s, they are worse now. Jobs, police hostility, housing, schools, welfare, medical care, all bad. And there's a change, too, in many persons. Despair, isolation, a notion that the color of evil is white. All the conditions recited as contributing to the riots, from depression like unemployment to slum housing, are to be found today. There is a widespread belief that the white man is at the root of the black man's troubles, that by white design, the cities are bleaker and a place to be shunned or ignored, that blacks and whites are on a collision course. There is no doubt that Detroit is an armed camp, said Thomas J. Pico, Jr., white deputy director of the Michigan Civil Rights Commission. Newark, said its black mayor, Kenneth A. Gibson, is a city with 16% unemployment, the highest crime rate in the nation, the highest percentage of substandard housing anywhere in the nation. Police departments are essentially white, racist institutions, and as such protect the investments of the white society. This is from Renault Robinson, Chicago Traffic Patrol, who heads the Afro-American Patrolman League. Very interesting. He was trying to get take his vacation in order to come out to California when Jesse Jackson, for whom he works as a kind of private bodyguard when he's off duty, and they wouldn't give him his vacation, so he just called in sick and came out to California. And when he got to California, the California police knew who he was and came up and accosted him. Tried to put him in jail because he was carrying a weapon, which he carries when he protects Jesse Jackson. Housing is a scandal, and the inescapable fact is that Uncle Sam is the biggest slumlord in the nation. This is from Representative John Conyers, black United States Democratic representative from Detroit. Unemployment. There may be a recession in America, but in the black community, it is a depression. And so forth. What I am really saying is that the ghetto is bleaker than ever. You may not think so. I think the majority of white Americans think that we're making progress on the black issue. And I would really like to begin our discussions and considerations, really in preparation for those of you who are going to be here next week, for four blacks who are coming here, so that we are ready, I think, and a little bit conditioned in terms of what the situation is from which they address us. And I hope it's helpful for me as a white person to prepare the ground, because I think I'll feel it strongly, almost as strongly, or that's impossible, feel it strongly as they do about the situation and about our inability and unwillingness to deal with it. So the first assertion then that I want to begin with is that the ghetto is bleaker than ever, and that there seems to be no will or way to deal with that bleakness. The blacks are somewhere between 10% and 15%, and with the birth rates, the zero population on the part of the white population, and the blacks will refuse this. And by, I would say, in 25 years, there'll probably be 25% of the population. We're really facing a situation in which we have a large minority that feels excluded from the American scene. And no matter how many people you may meet who are now in all of our institutions as kind of token blacks, and some of them are in high positions, the situation in the ghetto still remains one of despair and discrimination and unemployment and high crime rates and high infant mortality rates and high rates of birth outside of wedlock and everything that breeds insecurity and what we call a behavior that's deviant and makes our cities uninhabitable, and will continue to make them uninhabitable. And as one person, Andrew Hacker, I was just reading this morning, the friend of the American era, says, we have a civil war on our hands, really. We have a civil war on our hands. And that's the situation out of which I'd like to talk about black power, the hope of the world, with a question mark. And I want to in a sense talk about why black power, and part of the reason we need black power, it seems to me, is because of the danger of something happening, and how black power, and then the limits of black power. Is it the hope of the world? And then maybe, if there's time, I'd like to take a book like Albert Kleeg's Black Christian Nationalism and go through it. I've done a kind of a summary of the book in terms of what its assertions are, and I thought we might examine them, because many of the same assertions will be made by Cohn, I know, and in his books. He's the only one who has books, I think, who's coming up, and he has three books in the bookstore. And I think the least that some of us could do in preparation for next week is to read some of those books. As the least human thing it is to do, if you've got a guy like that coming, is to read his books and you know, get some preparation for it. I don't know how you feel, whether this picture is too bleak and too kind of pessimistic for you.
Can you give us a little background on these men who are coming, who they are, what they do, what they've done?
I can't do that. Somebody else will have to do that. I guess Willie Hertzfeld was what is it the ALC?
Missouri Synod.
Oh, Missouri Synod, that's right, Missouri Synod, Subcommission on Urban Affairs. Beg pardon?
Just in Oakland.
And James Cohen is a professor at Union Seminary.
One thing I've heard about Cohen, now he was just recently down in Berkeley giving some serious lectures at the Graduate Theological Union. And, I don't know, he felt those who were a part of the white, he's speaking mostly to the white establishment type of people. And it was very hard to engage him in this lecture. That's what one person said. So I don't know how you feel when this person said coming to this community. And there's many times a cult seems to be saying that the problem of racism, you know, is your problem. You've got to realize that you're oppressed too. Tell us my kids that, but why are you you're oppressed. You don't realize you're oppressed. The fact that you're oppressed, you know, you have perpetual resistance until you can get your next food out. You know, don't try, you know, be self-serving. Well, I don't know. Maybe I'm characterizing correctly, but he had heard. Isn't Herder a Lutheran up in Canada? President of the Senate in Canada.
Well, we'll hear him when he comes with this theology of liberation, and I'll deal with that a little in terms of whether the black movement can be a liberating movement for us. I don't know the other two. They're Leon and Emma Watts. And they don't even have on this sheet where they're from. And Mr. and Mrs. Bobby Saucer, those two are in kind of theology, black problems, sociology and theology. Well, we're going to have quite a time next week, I'm sure.
Is there a generally accepted definition for black power that sustains to all of us?
Well, I wanted to talk a little about that in terms of beginning to think about what black power might be. I wanted really to talk about power, and that might be a good way to proceed, because there are several kinds of power, and I would say roughly, and for our purposes, we could say there are three kinds of power, and I might say there's the power which is an other determination or power over, where we act because someone has some kind of reward or punishment that it can use to cause us to act, and we act in terms of that reward or punishment, or the power that we have to initiate things ourselves without other people limiting us. You can think of it as from the other point of view or from your own point of view. We sometimes call that control. But the chief means are economic and political and military means by virtue of which we move ourselves or control others. Now, there's a kind of power which is the power of the other person, but it's a power of his being. Not that he has any reward or punishment. You might say, you do it, something which another wants you to do because you love him or because he attracts you. We call that charisma, or leadership of charisma. You follow a person because you're attracted to him. And it's an internal principle of motion. You are persuaded. And a lot of times, I spent 15 years trying to persuade the power structure of Chicago to do things by presenting arguments and talking to people and presenting documents and statements of principle. And this, you are appealing to American tradition or to values or to conscience. And one of the things that King was trying to do in the South particularly, but even in Chicago when we were working, was to arouse the conscience. In other words, the marches were to raise an issue so that you would be aware that there was a problem. It was an educational process. So that once you saw that black people couldn't vote, you would do something about it. And you would do something about it because you were acting on what you thought was right. So that was not an attempt to control somebody's behavior. It was an attempt to induce it, to persuade, to appeal to the heart and the mind. That's another kind of thought. That's what I call, really, if you think about it, persuasion is over against control. Then there's another kind of power which comes out of oneself, and it has to do with yourself and not with what somebody else is doing or not your relating to somebody else, but it's the power that you have as a person to be. That is, we all know that people who are really mentally sick are kind of vegetables. They have no power to do anything. And this kind of power is a power to it's a kind of integration of oneself. And I often think, well, you've got to remove some compulsions frequently before you can act anything. And when you look at the proposals for dealing with the black and white issue, you get these different kinds of proposals. One proposal is that you help black people achieve pride, identity, and if they get their pride and identity, then they will be able to function in the society. One proposal goes so far as to say, do you really want a black person to function in a major institution, you'll have a psychiatrist on the staff to help him get the ego strength to function. He's been so destroyed by the destruction of his ego and his second-class personhood that you really have to have all kinds of support. And they will go so far as to say that the black family, with the dominance of the mother in most kinds of situations, not create a male image and therefore does not identity. And the problem, therefore, is to develop this kind of power, that is the power of being somebody. Others would say, well, our problem is to somehow to learn what is good and to persuade people by virtue of discussions and thinking and experience to be what we ought to be in terms of some notion of what the good is. So by education or preaching or persuasion, we are going to create a reality which the power of being is going to take over, and this problem will be solved by that kind of power. And the one I really want to talk about mostly, although I'd like to talk about those too, because I think they're involved, is the Black Power movement, in which these two are subordinated to the organization of black power, which is the black power of control. That is, it is the initiation of blacks of the use of their power. The kind of thing that Shirley Chisholm suggested, for example, in the Democratic Convention is that the black delegates would literally sell their votes in exchange for a black vice president and a black Secretary of the Interior, Secretary of Health and Welfare, and a brown Secretary of Interior, and a red Indian in charge of Indian affairs. I mean, she said, we'll sell our votes for that. That's what I mean. That kind of power is the kind of power I'm really going to focus upon, but in the course of it, we may want to talk about the other kinds of power. And I guess I would make the assertion, with all its risks, that unless the black people organize themselves literally to seize control of their destiny and to force, quote unquote, by use of their economic and political, I don't believe in the military, but by the use of their economic and political power, the white man to take them seriously will be in for trouble. Because I don't think we'll move alone. I don't think a white person has the least intention, anybody has the least intention really of moving as far and as fast with as many resources are required to deal even superficially with the problem, but I mean even begin to deal with the problem, and that the only way it will be dealt with is if the black people get organized and use their power, their political and economic power, to make it economically desirable and politically desirable to take them seriously. And for a number of years I was engaged in trying to do this. And now the question is, of course, what can we do in that? But I do think that the black people are not organized to do that for the most part. It's not an easy thing to organize interests and to get some unity. But the organization with which I was last attached, Jesse Jackson Push, was formerly known as Breadbasket, it's the same thing, same staff, same operation, with the exception that it's not related to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. But the whole organization just changed its name. That's really what happened. That organization was really organized to create this power. And it grew out of a theory that comes really from Reinhold Niebuhr, in which Niebuhr says that man's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, and his inclination to injustice makes it necessary. Now, by democracy, he means the self-initiation of the people, that is, the various units. And the famous essay, I think it's a famous essay, he says, what we haven't done in America in terms of this notion is the blacks haven't organized. As we had the organization of labor when there was a split between labor and management, and now labor is fat and sassy and conservative, but the thing is kind of evened out, whatever you think about it. That kind of happened when there was a real chance of revolution and real violence, and there was some violence, of course, in the organizing drive, but that we face the same situation with the blacks. The blacks are left out. And I know Jesse likes to say that you've got big labor and big management and big government, and then you have out on an island. That's the mainland. Out on an island, you've got the blacks. They're not a part of anything significant. And until they organize themselves to get in, there'll be a colony. They'll be treated just like a colony. They'll be milked, and that's exactly what has happened. They've been just milked by our society. And during the wars, when we need labor, we bring them into the labor force. As soon as we don't need them, last hired, first fired. It's really true. And so their unemployment is much higher than in the white communities. So that the problem then is for them to get organized. And so that's really where I was spending my life. And I was actually, at the last part, for various reasons, simply the business agent for 60 black contractors, getting them work and getting them into the system with all the problems of black capitalism, I mean, because you've got real questions about that. But at any rate, we were getting them into the system. And when I say black power, hope of America, there's a sense in which I really think this division in America between black and white will not be healed without black power. And so if you really are concerned about the future fabric of America, you've got to accept black power as the hope, quote unquote, there are bigger hopes, but hope of America. For unless black power is able to force white power to take black reality seriously, we'll have a civil war. Now, if you are a true conservative, you would recognize the rising expectations of a whole class, a whole group of people, of black people, which have been denied, and you would admit them into the system. But for some reason or other, and I guess it's human, we have not admitted them into the system. So the only way they're going to get into the system is to force their way into the system. Now, if you believe the system is going to be destroyed if they don't get into the system, and you don't see any hope for the white people really inviting them into the system, then you have to put your hope in black power. And that's what I do. As a man's, you know, inclination to injustice is so strong that his inclination or capacity for justice is not really overcome, or not really doesn't function to admit the black into justice. Now, I think the blacks really have a sense that there is no justice. So it's really very difficult for me to understand how they can be loyal. I wondered during World War II, why weren't they the fifth column? And in a sense, they weren't the fifth column because of their religion. And what Albert Klieg says in Black Christian Nationalism, therefore, that their black church is really an instrument of white power establishment, I believe it. Their religion actually prevented them from asserting themselves and therefore makes it possible for the white people who take advantage of them, the so-called establishment, to continue to take advantage of them. And so you've got a real problem, because the black church is a kind of a safety valve. And all their frustration, you know, I remember going, I used to go to these black churches, and I'd always be asked to go on the platform, because I had kind of relationship to all kinds of black ministers through the movement. And I remember in this one church, when they carried out 15 people, literally, you know, they got the spirit, man. They were getting rid of, I don't know what they were getting rid of, but man, they got rid of it. And five or six guys would descend on them and carry them out, literally carry them out. And he said to me, the minister said to me, he said, "You tell Jesse," he said, "we got the spirit here." And it's a strange kind of spirit. I say it's a substitute in many ways. That kind of seizure and so forth, you know, in many ways, you know, I'm very leery about judging it, but their whole religion really, and you'll find it in many black analyses now of the black church, was an attempt to see their meaning in another world, because they didn't have any meaning here, or their meanings here were so limited, they were so circumscribed in terms of what they could do here. So you're going to get many attacks on the black church from black theologians. And Klieg, I think, is the strongest that I've read, who is you know, a man of some stature and of some system and order and meaning. You get all kinds of attacks, but I think Klieg's Black Nationalism, a book we really need to take seriously. Because I would expect Klieg's net black nationalism. He says the black church has got to be the instrument of liberation for the black person. And it has no other meaning. I would expect this to expand, just like the Muslim movement has expanded in a way, where black way black really is lifted up, kind of, and a real danger in lifting it up, because of the fact that man is one, is really going to be denied for a while in order to get the black community together. And there is some truth, of course, I think, to the fact that some of the black values in the black community are superior to our values in terms of their life and their humanness. But in many ways, they're no different, although there's kind of a claim. Well, I've talked about power, so what I'm really trying to say is that we ought to welcome black power movements, which talk about political and economic power. And as Jesse always says, it is futile in this country when you're a minority to talk about military power. You haven't got the stuff. And Jesse, of course, at least seems to come out of the nonviolent movement that King started and continue that. So that it seems to me it's a great boon to have a non-violent power-oriented movement, and we ought to welcome it and support it. About the only thing we could do is finance it. But it's the very most difficult thing in the world to finance. You can finance every kind of a scheme in the world except one which understands power in the black community. And the organization that understands power, it's the most difficult. The money that's been poured into crackpot ideas is getting nowhere in the black community. And in my judgment, it's over against the money that is poured into some organization that really has some hope for bridging this gap and providing a reconciliation. It's a reconciliation that comes not out of the heart of the white person, but it's a reconciliation that is forced upon the white person because he has to take another person seriously. Now, there's a danger and reaction to that, of course, but there is where man's capacity for justice and the bigness of a person comes in, because if we really have a bigger heart on this issue than we think we have, and we could respond better, but we've never been confronted with it. And frequently when we go into a corporation and confront a corporation with such simple things as where they hold their annual party or something, a country club that excludes black people, and all kinds of things, very simple things, but prepared an inventory of racism in corporate life with about, I suppose, 250 items on it in terms of how you do your recruiting. If you do self-recruiting, you don't have a recruiting section in the black ghetto, you're going to have real difficulty. If you think people are going out in the suburbs to get a job, it doesn't work. I mean, all kinds of things are involved. And frequently we found that when you got in and began to work with a company, with a little pressure too, they responded, and responded very well. I frequently use the illustration of the president of Juul, who's since deceased, but he was a grand man and really welcomed us in a sense. But at one negotiation, he said, he'd flown back from Japan because he was a deacon in the church. And Jesse turned, looked at me and winked, no. Coming out of this Niebuhrian analysis, we knew that he flew back from Japan chiefly because we were threatening to take the black business from about 40 stores in the ghetto. And that, he was a good man and he responded well, but he responded much better if he had a little bit of a shove. Much better. Much with more seriousness and more rapidly. And so what I want to say, I guess, this morning is that the ghetto is really very bleak, and it's the potential source of a civil war in this country, and that there's very little being done of a serious nature to tackle those problems. And the problems are so large that we require major kinds of shifts in priorities, and that the kind of shifts that are required will not take place unless the white community in some way or other becomes aware or is forced to take those shifts into account. And I think that the organization of the black community into a power block could take place if the resources were available, could take place, and that would be the best thing that could happen in America. And so that we ought to welcome the caucuses in our churches. It's very hard in the Lutheran Church because there's so few blacks to get this kind of power. And that's one of the reasons why you get all kinds of shenanigans going on in order to draw our attention to the kind of situation, because there isn't economic and political power, there isn't even voting power, it's such a small proportion, and it's not an easy thing. But we are very open, I think, to the situation that straits people in, despair that you face when you're a black, and you face the overwhelming power and the overwhelming domination of the white society. Now perhaps that's enough to get things started.
Now, there was one thing you said I didn't understand about somebody carrying these people out of church. What was the purpose of the fire?
Well, I was just saying that their religion has become, in a sense, a very emotional escape from their frustration, and it becomes a kind of a really emotional orgy, in a sense, which in one way is a result of their failure to have some of the satisfaction. They are denied. They are suppressed. They are unhappy in almost every relationship. And here, I think it just becomes a kind of real escape valve for them.
Yes, I still don't understand the mechanics of carrying somebody out. What?
They are really seized. And
these are the people who are removed.
And they're just removed, and they have nurses on duty, and they're taken off to other rooms. And,
it's black people that are being carried out,
not. Oh, no. No, I was the only white person there.
Yeah. Well, I understand now.
But how do you respond then to people like Homer, you know, private, you know, families, carrying the troops for black churches? There was, you know, a real basis.
No, I think that there's as a matter of fact, I'd rather listen to black preaching than any preaching I hear mostly. That is that I was only saying that this is a kind of a outlet that they have been, and could be the basis for a lot of criticism. They have had to be all kinds of things to all people. I went to a church for a while. I once got the idea that the way to get solve this problem in the church was to get the white people to go to the black churches. So I was preaching that to the Church Federation Annual Conference and other things. So I had to do it myself. And so I did that. And this church was a marvelous. It lasted 2.5 hours. And it was two services, really. We had the Rockefeller Memorial Choir there, practically, I mean, in terms of the music. Then you had the gospel choir. He was ministering to everybody, and the first part of his sermon was just like any sermon that anybody would preach in Rockefeller Chapel or theologically sound. Then he'd start whooping it up, you know, for the other church that had been used to a different kind of... So that there was, you know, it was a very strange mixture, and very positive in dealing with the needs. Now, for the most part, the church has been this kind of community center, but it's also been, I'd say, an escape mechanism for the fact that they are second-class persons, and it's a little bit unreal, and has, in a sense, prevented them from expressing their hostilities and their negativities in the culture. And I think, in a sense, they should have expressed their negativities and hostilities a long time ago.
Why do you think that is the sort of an escape for these spiritual seizures or things you're talking of? When we in the whites, we have sex who probably have the same experiences. And they aren't.
Yeah, well, I may push that too hard. I would just say that, generally speaking, they've talked about a religion in which the meaning of life is found above history and not in history. Above history, outside of history, at the end of your life. And you have that to look forward to.
They have nothing else.
That's right. And I see our faith saying, in its classical expression, that there's meaning in history and above history. And that's why I'm a little leery of saying that this kind of seizure and so forth isn't legitimate. or that this kind of real emotional kind of relationship, which takes you out of the ordinary and you're in a different world. I hesitate to say this, but if that's all you have, it seems to me you have some real problems. And it seems to me that for the most part, that's all they did have. Because they were denied. They were simply treated not as human beings.